I am delighted to be joined today by the award-winning poet and tutor, Claire Shaw. Claire is a keen advocate for writing as a tool of social and personal change. As a project lead for the Royal Literary Fund, they were responsible for setting up writing projects in workplaces across the UK. Claire was a resident poet for Lancashire Wildlife Trust in 2021, and they continue to use poetry to engage communities with wildlife and ecology. In collaboration with the novelist Winnie M. Lee, Claire was the recipient of a Royal Society of Literature Matters Award in 2019, creating workshops and a free online resource for survivors of trauma. Claire Shaw has four poetry collections with Blood Axe. Their latest collection, Towards a General Theory of Love, was awarded a Northern Writers Award and was published in May 2022. Claire is co-director of the Pendle Poetry Festival and a regular tutor for Wordsworth Grasmere and the Arvon Foundation. Claire, welcome to Daring to be Different.
Thank you. Hiya.
It's great to have you here from Hebden Bridge, one of my favourite parts of the world. So, Claire, tell me, has poetry always been such an important part of your life?
I don't know that I've sprung from the womb reading or quoting poetry, but I think one of my earliest memories of poetry, and I think I was always a fairly unusual child, was my granddad. My mum had a big stack of encyclopedias from my granddad, and I just loved them. And I've still got a thing about old books. And one of the things I particularly loved in these old encyclopedias was the poetry. So I was clearly drawn to kind of rhythmic and regular formal poetry from, you know, a really unusually young age. But I know the point where I really leapt into loving it in a big way was around about the age of 8 or 9. Like lots of people, I was brought into it by a particular teacher, and my teacher was Mrs. O'Hara. So I was a big reader, always loved reading, but Mrs. O'Hara was just so excited by creative writing and by poetry that she kind of sparked something in me that I don't think ever went out after that point.
Wow. And were there any favourite poets that you'd pick up and think, this means something to me?
Now or
through? Well, when you were little, I'm just wondering, when you were little, when you sort of had that sort of new brain that hadn't absorbed anything yet.
No, that's why I look back and think I was really drawn to the kind of regular stuff, the stuff that came in verses with rhymes. You know, I loved the fact that rhyme had this kind of memorable echo, and the song and the music of rhyme really spoke to me, as it's meant to when I was little. And it is, you know, particularly appealing to children. That's why we have nursery rhymes. But obviously my tastes have kind of changed and evolved over the years, but I still have a pull to rhyme, although not necessarily in such a kind of defined, formal, regular form now.
So you're reading this poetry, it's very influential on you, teachers are very influential on you. Like a lot of us growing up, loving books and loving poets, how did you make that leap, though, from loving it and being absorbed in it to doing it as a career? I mean, it's amazing.
It is really, isn't it? Jackie Kay, Caroline Duffy. Wrote like lots of people for myself, for friends, for girlfriends, just to get stuff out of my head for years and years and years. And, you know, I was good at it. I obviously had a way with words. We all have a way with something, and words was my thing. And I got myself on an advanced writing course. I think I was in my just in my 30s at this point, and I'd had a very rough time through my 20s. But I was doing some writing courses mainly just for fun, entering a few little competitions, doing a few open mics. And I went on this course with Caroline Duffy and Jackie Kay, who were both, you know, they're everybody's heroes, and quite rightly, particularly if you're lesbian or LGBTQ in any form. And they sort of picked me up, as that's not as dodgy as it sounds, not at any point, I will not fuel the rumours. But Caroline invited me to be, you know, in essence, the kind of resident poet with her at Caroline Duffy and Friends at the Royal Exchange. And Jack Kay nominated me for a big award, Arvon Young Writers Award, which I won. And things took off in a really dramatic way from that point. So I kind of leapfrogged. a lot of the usual process. Although, obviously, having said that, it had been a very long road to that point, and I did put the work in. I just didn't have to take the normal route that people often do of submitting to journals and building up a CV. Mine was a slightly different route.
And do you feel like, as you've got older, your poetry's probably been more informed, because the more we live, the richer our writing becomes?
Oh, God, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I can certainly see it in my last book. I'm very proud of the last book, and there's a sense of kind of completeness. When I say the last book, it only came out a few weeks ago. It's a new baby still. But I'm already beginning working on the fifth book, and I have quite a clear idea of the sort of stylistic and formal leaps that I want it to take. I've kind of gone, you know what, I think I've been writing in a particular way for enough years now. And it's fairly sort of accessible and lyrical way. And I never want to lose the accessibility. I don't want to become some really obtuse, difficult poet. I'm not clever enough. And neither do I want to lose the lyricism. I really sort of revel in the beauty of language. So I still want writing to have a beauty and an appeal to it. But there are elements of language that I've not even begun to kind of harness. Like the visual elements of language, like white space, like kind of experimental forms. And that's where I want to go next. And it's really exciting to go these ways of writing that I've hardly begun to engage with yet. Off I go. You know, I'm about to turn 50 and I'm absolutely trying new things with writing.
Wow. That's fantastic. I wanted to ask you about your collaboration with Winnie M. Lee. How did that come about with your work around trauma?
Well, I've always written from trauma. I mean, I've always written from my life, and my life has included a fair share of trauma. And I've always been fascinated by how we might capture that in language. It's possibly one of the reasons that I write. I'm very drawn to the idea of that we can capture almost any experience in language, even when it feels like it's beyond language, and trauma is obviously one of those things, you know, but there are certain experiences of joy that can also feel like they're beyond language. And that's where I think poetry steps in, because it doesn't have to have, you know, a sensible, logical narrative. It doesn't have to make sense. It can be full of contradiction. It can draw on, you know, metaphor, which is just like the most completely brilliant descriptive device. It doesn't have to make sense. So poetry, I think, can be a really powerful language for capturing really intense experiences, and obviously having had intensely horrible experiences. And when we can't speak intensely horrible experiences, they can become even more damaging and even more formative when we can't bring them into words. So I've always been driven by that task. And then just by chance, I was tutoring an Arvon course. When you're tutoring an Arvon course, you have a guest reader for one night. And our guest reader I was working with, I can't remember, was it Ben Ficini? No, it was Jim Friel. It was brilliant novelist Jim Friel. And we had this guest reader, Winnie M. Lee, who neither of us had heard of, with her first crime fiction novel, Dark Chapter. And I thought, oh, crime fiction, you know, that'll be a nice, relaxing read. I'll read that while I'm tutoring. You know, that'll be what I chill out with at night. And actually, Dark Chapter is Winnie's, I don't know why it's described as crime fiction. I think it's completely wrongly genred. It's, you know, it's literary fiction. It's creative nonfiction. It's a very loosely fictionalized account of her own rape when she was brutally assaulted in Belfast, I think 14 years ago. And she does this incredible thing of kind of explaining the psychology of the attacker as well as her own experience in a very, very loosely fictionalized account. So it's a really remarkable novel that completely blew my socks off and sort of took over this week. And me and Winnie really hit it off, as did Winnie and Jim. And we all had a great time together and a great laugh together. And we've remained really firm friends ever since. But obviously inevitably for me, we've ended up working together. Winnie was the founder of a festival called Clear Lines arts festival which harnesses art and literature, art of any kind, to bring sexual assault and sexual consent into awareness and discussion. And I've got very involved in that. And as a kind of side project, we applied for Royal Society of Literature, Literature Matters Award, and we spent a year taking workshops and readings out around the UK, because then we had the pandemic, we had to slightly swerve, and instead we developed an online resource that's about enabling other people to bring their trauma into language, and particularly the trauma of sexual abuse, sexual assault, sexual violence.
Wow, gosh, that's incredibly powerful, and a great alliance that you made during that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a great friendship and a great working relationship, and it will, you know, it will continue. Just worked with Winnie last week, actually. I was chairing a panel of writers at the Bradford Literary Festival, and Winnie's second novel, which is called Complicit, and her novels are on the ascendance, and she's writing this screenplay and this film rights and all sorts batting around. But Complicit looks at Me Too, and it looks at the Hollywood film industry, and, you know, it's very, very timely. It looks at abuse of power, and it looks at kind of responsibility and the value, but also the cost of speaking out, and how we make our decisions around, do we speak out or don't we? How do we, each and every single one of us, kind of place ourselves within that debate about speaking out?
It's a very good point, because when we write, we expose ourselves to different degrees, and you can't ever take that back, can you? Have you ever felt like that? You've written something because you are very, very personal in your approach, and then felt?
No, I don't think I have. I don't think I have. I think I've sailed very close to the wind, and I have to really think about it. And the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case has made me think about it even more. That there are things that I don't talk about. There are experiences and people and stories that I haven't told, although they've been told in the most loose of senses through, you know, if we have had an important formative experience, we're always talking about it. And sometimes we're talking about it because it occupies a space in ourselves, and we can only speak from the shape around it. So the absences in what we say are our ways of talking about it. So I think, you know, I do speak from my inability to talk about certain experiences. And there are all sorts of reasons that there's some stuff that I don't talk about. But I think poetry does give you a relatively sheltered way of speaking, because you can draw on all these different devices like metaphor and simile, and you can speak in different characters, and it doesn't have to make sense. And more often than not, we're not telling stories. You know, we're holding up a single moment to the light and examining everything through the prism of that moment. And I know that recently I've started writing more kind of prose. Written a play that was on Radio 4. I'm writing some essays and pieces for radio at the moment, and I find that much more exposing. Actually, you don't have as much to hide behind as you do in poetry.
Yeah, no, that I think that's absolute fair shout. Would you be able to read some of your poetry to us today, please?
I would. What do you want? What kind of stuff?
Well, I think something from your latest book would be fabulous, Towards a General Theory of Love.
Right, of course. It's hard to pick because the book has lots of separate parts to it, although it is all united by being Towards a General Theory of Love. So the previous three collections have had, you know, some fairly dark material in them, though lots of sort of light and humour as well. And with this book, I did make a really deliberate decision of thinking, now, what do I want to spend the next two or three years thinking about? And I thought about love, but obviously love inevitably takes you into some dark areas. So there's quite a sizable chunk of the book is given over to my mother and my mother's death. And then there's a sequence of poems that are kind of like the spine of the book about this little character, Monkey. Yeah. And I think I'll read a Monkey poem. So Monkey comes from, he comes from a sequence of experiments that were carried out in the 1960s by a psychologist called Harry Harlow, You might have heard of him. And Harry Harlow did these momentously controversial, cruel, but also very important experiments on baby rhesus monkeys, where he essentially kind of proved the science of love and the importance of touch and maternal affection in particular, by completely depriving little rhesus monkeys of touch and maternal affection and subjecting them to various cruelties and looking at the impact on them. And when people aren't loved or touched, they suffer, and sometimes they go mad and sometimes they die. And that was the finding. So yeah, tremendously cruel. And in my book, a little monkey kind of comes to walk with me through the book and teaches me what he knows. Yeah, I'm going to read Monkey Invites Me to Imagine. So by the end of the book, it's like I don't know which one's me, monkey or me. Monkey invites me to imagine. I am walking in snow for the first time, and my paws are bare. The fields seem endless, and I cannot make sense of the sky. The air is rapid and quiet. It burns, but Monkey is peaceful. He bids me notice that sheep are not actually white, that some pain is worth it. He does not tell me to put my boots on, not to eat it. When you come late to snow, says Monkey, you will always be ready to stand under the moon to watch it fall. Sometimes I don't know which of us is Monkey, especially now when he's leading me carefully up to my room and we stop by the high window so that I can stare at the snow. Look how beautiful it is. For this night, at least, no harm will come to us.
Wow, that's so powerful. And I can't help feeling, you know, having bought your book and read your poetry, to hear you read it is a different level of understanding of the poetry. Yeah. It's the performance aspect is really important. Thank you.
Really interesting, isn't it, the balance around page and performance, because I do write for the page. That's where the poetry belongs. But you know, also, as you mentioned, I'm one of the directors of the Kendal Poetry Festival, and that's all about bringing people together to listen to poetry being read. And we're very careful at Kendal Poetry Festival to always have captions and screen sharing, because it's an inclusive festival and people who are deaf or hard of hearing need to be able to take part too. But one of the benefits is you can see it on the page and hear it at the same time. And without a doubt, hearing the poetry completely changes the experience. And you know, why should I need reminding of that? But every year I am reminded of that. Oh my God, this is so different. Reading Imtiaz Darker on the page is incredible. She's an incredible artist. But seeing the woman stood up in front of me, just experiencing the kind of human being of her, yes, and hearing her read, that's a different thing altogether. And it alters your reading from that point on, I think.
Wow. Well, I'm just blown away by the difference of the experience. So thank you very much for sharing that. I wanted to ask you, you're a parent. Also, and I just wondered how much that influenced you or changed your work since becoming a parent.
Everything changes your work. Absolutely everything that you go through changes your work, even just the form of it. So William Carlos Williams, I always think of him. He was a GP. He was a nice guy. He was one of the kind of inventors, if you like, of imagism. He kind of set the tone for 20th century poetry. Little poems with single images or very minimal poetry. And one of the reasons was he was a GP and he worked on a prescription pad in between appointments with patients. So what I mean to say is, once you have a baby and you have no time to yourself and you're absolutely knackered, your form of writing will change. And you always have to go, don't panic. Just because you don't write like you did before doesn't mean that, you know, your career is over, it's all finished. You're just writing differently. You're writing in the time you've got available to you, you know, with the means that you've got available to you. So absolutely, the way that I write changed to write much more quickly. and of course, you know, my teenager, who's 14 now, is a formative experience in just about every element of my life. So of course, the experience of being a parent is a huge element of my work. And, you know, it's very much there in Towards a General Theory of Love, because being open to the world, seeing the world in a different way, when you have a child, you are no longer contained inside your own skin. You're not just... Because you have no control over where this human's going to go or what their life is going to be, you know, beyond your role as a protector, you are just open to the world in an entirely new way. So of course it's there in the work, yeah.
Wow, and also, you know, you identify as queer. I wonder how much your coming out story had informed your writing also.
Yeah. Again, you know, again, I'll go, well, everything informs your work. God, I mean, that's a constantly changing story. Again, you know, I grew up, identified as lesbian until relatively recently, and I grew up in Burnley in the 70s and 80s in a Catholic, very right wing family at a time when being gay was generally bloody difficult. Went to Catholic schools. It was never, ever okay. It was the opposite of okay to be me or to have the feelings or the desires or the love that I had. So, yeah, it's been hugely important to me to be able to express and give form to desire and love in poetry. A real driving force. What I've noticed recently, so I talked a bit about in the fifth book, I'm looking at different forms, and I think that's probably paralleled in my kind of sexuality and my gender identity, because it takes a certain kind of confidence to go, I've changed my mind, or I'm just going to go one step further with exploring this identity and see if maybe what I've taken for granted for decades isn't so. Yeah. And that's true in my writing and it's true in my gender. So kind of gone, you know, clearly I'm a woman, I've got tits, I've got a vagina, I've given birth, I'm a woman. And now I go, I'm not so sure. And that's okay. But it takes confidence to say you're not sure. Same way as in writing, you know, it's easy to write in stanzas and rhymes and to fall back on lyricism and to go to the same topics, whereas to go, I'm going to mix it up and try something new. It takes a certain kind of confidence to do that. So, yeah, again, I think, yeah, lots of parallels. And I've just been part of a new anthology that's come out with Faber, 100 Queer Poems, I think it's called. And it's absolutely brilliant. I would absolutely recommend it. And I think if you read that and you've got, you know, queer poetry going back to Auden and, you know, some of our kind of real... pathbreakers. We could go back to Shakespeare for that matter, Sappho, but it's more contemporary poetry. But I think the forms that you're seeing in queer poetry do also express the fact that there's been a real kind of paradigm shift in how we frame our sexualities and our gender expressions, and that a lot of us having absolutely needed and valued and celebrated and with massive respect, you know, built our community around one vision of our gendered selves are now going, we've reached this point and I think it's okay for us to think about the next stage and to go, it's shifting. There are new possibilities. Sometimes we don't know quite where we're going. Let's roll with it. Let's see what exciting possibilities that offers, and I think I feel that in my writing as well.
Wow, I you know, I said earlier you teach as well. You must be massively inspirational to the students in your class. But I just wonder, what have you learned from working with other people and teaching them the creative process?
Oh my God, like everything. There's no cut off between like popular culture or high art or people, you know, writing a line of poetry for the first time. It is all part of the same whole. So like I say, I've just come back from Kendal Poetry Festival. It was mind-blowing. It was brilliant. We had the best poets in the country there, and they were even better than normal. Joelle Taylor, Intiaz Darke, newer poets who were going to absolutely lead the field. Nafisa Hamid, Rachel Mann, absolutely amazing. And then on Wednesday, I was working in Burnley with a group of kids with learning disabilities, 8 lads, 1 girl. And none of them did any, you know, they weren't writing on paper. We were writing together and I was writing up their ideas on a board. And we wrote 4 group poems together over 3 hours. And the work was just astonishing. And it was just, you know, I get quite teary thinking about it. It was just a brilliant 3 hours. And the school was fantastic. The teachers were fantastic. And that way of celebrating, you know, like one of the lads, the fact that he, at the end of the session, walked up quite close to the teacher and me and said that the session had been okay. And the teacher was just absolutely over the moon, because he said the fact that this lad had managed to stay in the room, let alone walked close to us, was just mind-blowing. And when he was telling the other teachers, they were like, wow. And what those kids were coming up with for the first time, the fact that they sat there and they gave me their ideas and they shared them, and they smiled and they responded to the poetry that was being read out. Like, that is an inspiration beyond anything else. It's seeing in the moment that language is vital and transformative and connective, and like, that's just magic. That's just lifeblood. The work that I'm doing out on the I'm working on little mould and moss on these wetlands in Lancashire. And at the moment, I'm writing an audio trail. I'll send you the link for it, because you can do it. So it's getting people out on the wetlands themselves and responding to it in writing. And I took a group of people, a mixed group. So some of them had learning difficulties, some neurodivergent, some were asylum seekers, just a group of people that come together to in a community, in a greenhouse. And there was a woman who'd only been over here for 8 months, who came from Iraq, and the marshes sparked off in her what's kind of thoughts and feelings around the marshes in Iraq, which are the biggest marshlands in the world. And she was talking about the food that they eat there and the people that live there. And how would I ever know that?
Yeah.
How would I ever know that when I'm standing in, you know, little Walden Marsh next to Cadis Head? I would never know that. I would appreciate, you know, the swallows, and I'd appreciate the dragonflies, but I wouldn't think of the, you know, the marsh Arabs eating this buffalo milk yogurt in the mornings, sitting on the rooftop. So people constantly enrich you in every sense with what they give you, of themselves, of their willingness, of their love. There was a woman who'd only just started coming to the group, and she brought cake for everybody. And you know, that sort of stuff touches me enormously. And just what people prove over and over again about, you know, language is magical. I'm sorry, that was a really long answer. But I'm really
it's passionate. A great answer. So if you could talk to yourself at 20, put yourself back there. You might not want to. Might not have been the funniest of times. If you could think of yourself at 20, what would you say to 20-year-old you to give yourself some inspiration?
Oh my God, 20 was a really tough time. At 20, I tried to kill myself for the first time. I was about to begin 6 years of being in and out of psychiatric hospital. It was an exceptionally grim time for me. 20. What I would say, I think that I couldn't tell myself a massive amount because I've transformed in many ways. But I would have to speak to the parts of me that are still like the parts I carry now. And I would say, you will get through this. I would say, you've got rough times coming and you will get through this. And you will be able to look back at it and life will be good. And you're just going to have to grit your teeth and keep breathing. And I'd say, notice the small moments. Because I think even when we go through the most awful times in our lives, there are always small moments that keep us going. And I remember in particular being on the psychiatric ward, being detained, and there were trees outside my window. And that was so sustaining. And I'm just doing some work at the moment on trees, and I'm reading about studies that show that people do recover faster from surgery if they even just have sight of a tree outside of the window. So I'd say that to myself, just look for the small moments, just keep breathing. You will get through this. This will pass. Other people are going to bring you through it. You're going to bring yourself through it. It's going to get better. I think that's all that I could say to myself at 20.
Wow. So thinking about that, what's the best advice you were given along the way?
The best advice I've been given?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This too will pass. Yeah. It's a cliche because it's true. Everything does pass, including the good things. I keep using this phrase, I'm nearly 50, because it is a really formative time. And I've had a few excruciatingly difficult months. I've had some really, really big health scares. I've had some lesions and some tumours, and I've had to kind of stare mortality in the face and go, yeah, it does all pass, and life itself passes. And I've got to roll with that as much as I've rolled with, you know, the terrible things passing. The good things pass too. A lightness of touch around both joy and horror and love, it does pass. Even your strongest connections will pass. You can't be here forever. They can't be here forever. You know, the only thing that remains are things like, God, I sound like a big old hippie, but trees and fields and sky, they'll be here much longer than you. So you can look to them if you need permanence. So this too will pass. Also, back to Julian of Norwich, I am turning into a massive hippie or some sort of spiritual guru that I don't quite recognize, but all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. That eventually things do have this really bloody weird way of turning out all right, even though they are horrible and life can be really challenging. It generally finds some sort of equilibrium. And then I think I'm great friends with the poet Kim Moore. We run the poetry festival together. Kim's fantastic poet, check her out. She's on the Ford Prize shortlist at the moment with her book, All the Men I Never Married. And Kim writes about a violent domestic relationship in her first book, and it's also present in the second. And she has a big tattoo on her arm, a room of one's own, that she said when she was weighing up what tattoo to have, she also thought about tattooing the line, no one is coming, which I think is a phrase that came to her in a dream when she was in this domestically violent relationship. And it sounds like such a stark phrase, no one's coming, you've got to do it yourself, no one's going to save you from this. It sounds dreadful when you're in bad suffering, but it is also true. No one can save you but yourself. And in that, there is a kind of power in it. So I'm going to add that to the mix. I'm going to add, this too will pass. No one's coming. All will be well. And I think my final kind of, this is not being advice, but this is my advice, is grace. It's the word grace. I come back to that word a lot. I come back to, you know, whatever you're facing, if you can find in yourself grace to face it with, it carries you. It's not about anybody else. It's about you the word grace is just kind of my watchword. Carry grace into it. And it's like a little protective cloud that can carry you.
Wow. That's really powerful, Claire. Thank you. I'm going to transport you a little bit now. And I'm going to send you on a dinner date.
Oh my God.
I know.
Brilliant.
We're going on a dinner date anywhere in the world with anybody you want, past, present, alive, dead, fictitious, real. I don't mind. Who do you want to go on a dinner date with?
Well, I've had a little candle for Kay from Desert Hearts for a very long time, so it's really difficult not to say Kay from Desert Hearts, obviously.
Great choice.
I've kind of got a lot older now, not got quite the same appeal. I'm Kate Bush's number one fan for sure, but I think if I went on a dinner date with Kate, I'd just choke on my food. So I've got to go for, out of just sheer nerves and overcomeness, I do get a bit flustered if I've got a flame for someone. So I'm going to choose someone who really interests me. I've been fascinated for years and years and years and years. Since I was a teenager growing up in Burnley, I've been fascinated by the Pendle Witches. Yeah. So I think if you know the story of the Pendle Witches, and if you don't, check it out. one of the most kind of the biggest mysteries with the Pendle Witches is Alice Nutter. So everybody else was like, absolutely brassic, penniless, and you think, well, that's the typical story, the poor people and the women get it in the neck, and a couple of men, including a man with learning difficulties, they were the ones who were persecuted and hung. But in the middle of them was this gentlewoman, Alice Nutter, really wealthy woman, also a Catholic, and no one can quite work out what was going on with Alice. Like, how did she get caught up in all this ruckus? You know, why couldn't she save herself with her money? And I think me and Alice will go out on the dinner date. Okay. One, because I want to say I'm really bloody sorry about what happened to you, Alice, and you've not been forgotten. And two, because I want to go, now tell me what actually happened.
That would be fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Claire, tell me what you're working on at the moment.
I am working on two pieces. So I'm working on this audio trail for Little Walden Moss, which is just brilliant because I get to do lots of research about things like bog bodies and the Worsley Man and bog oaks and all the kind of folklore attached to the trees and the plants in the area. And I'm getting to learn about birds, but also to think about the human stories that are reflected in the bogs. So Little Walden Moss, Chat Moss, massive area of bogland that was largely destroyed, but 98% of it has been lost. But people are working really hard to restore it. So there's lots of resonance for me in terms of recovery and restoration. Okay. And things coming back to a state that's a bit different, but in some ways even more meaningful because they speak about recovery.
Amazing. Claire, thank you for daring to be different and changing the game for LGBTQI people and using your talents to enact social change. My final question for you today is, what would your strapline or hashtag be that captures your amazing energy?
Oh, you know what? I didn't know about my energy. You know, sometimes it takes somebody to hold up to a mirror to you to go, do you know what? You're really quite energetic.
You are.
Since that point, people have reflected it back a lot. But that first time was when we were talking about if we were Smurfs. Do you remember the Smurfs?
Yeah. The little blue things.
Yeah, yeah. And they were like kind of named by their qualities.
Okay.
Yeah, and they said, you're enthusiasm Smurf. So maybe it's enthusiasm Smurf, but that kind of doesn't quite capture the, you know, I also am quite thoughtful. So maybe I would go a bit Winnie the Pooh and go, you know, I am a mixture absolutely of Tigger, but I am also partly Owl.
Oh.
That, yeah. Claire Shaw, a lot of Tigger and a bit of Owl. I was talking to someone yesterday and I was trying to summarise my kind of attitude to life, and I thought I think it's reflected by my mother's attitude to a buffet, which is you eat as much as you can, and what you can't, you put in your handbag and eat later. I think I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say life is a buffet. Just fill your boots, like literally. And that means stuff that you don't like as well as stuff that you do like.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cheers. It's been really great. Thank you.
Just finished chatting with Claire Shaw. It was a completely moving experience, but also really funny and touching. I think the power of words and also the power of performance, you know, can't be underestimated. The way that we make those connections, the way that we use our voice, the way that we use our language, the way that we unite people and pull them together with a sense of identity. Claire Shaw, really, really thank you so much for sharing your experiences. It's going to stay with me for a very long time. Thank you.